This is KTRU on 96.1 KTRU, LP Houston, streaming live on your phone and on the web at ktru.org. From the Rice University campus, I'm Rishab Kathari, and you're tuned in to Thinking Different. In the area of personalized medicine, where the focus is to treat each individual patient or group of patients in a way tailored to their specific needs, the one-size-fits-all model can feel somewhat ineffective. With me is Dr. Stephanie Coulter, a cardiologist at the Texas Medical Center and the director of the Center for Women's Heart and Vascular Health. She's passionate about women's heart health and is dedicated to addressing women's unique needs in this field. Dr. Coulter, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Great.
Well, I'd love to talk about the particular projects you've been involved with in the past, but before we can do so, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background and what it is about women's heart health that motivates you and has captivated your interest?
Well, I'm a Texan. My parents are from Fort Worth, and I grew up a little bit in Louisiana, so I have an outsider's mentality, I guess, but I went to medical school here and went to college in Texas, and then moved to Boston and did about, you know, almost 9 years of training in one of the three Harvard hospitals. So I moved around every chance I got, which actually I think is a very good way to train, because you're forced outside of your comfort zone every 3 years, and you have to reprove yourself, and you learn different, you know, cultures and how people conduct medicine, and not one size fits all, like you were saying.
Sure.
You know, so having a broad experience, I think, was actually good for me. And eventually I moved back home after I had two children, and my husband worked in the oil and gas industry, typical Texans. And
sure.
I felt very often when I lived in Boston that at the end I was alone a lot, and I was like a bird on a limb in a small nest with two babies, and I wasn't sure if I could survive. You know, I had to travel a lot, and I just decided it was time to move back to the mother's den, so to say, and I was glad I did, but it was a big transition moving back, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What were some of the lessons that you brought back to Texas with you from the East Coast?
Well, it's funny is that in Boston, there were a lot more women in medicine, particularly even in cardiology. So when I was a fellow, there were a good number of other physicians that were females, cardiology fellows that were females, and even attendings above me were females. Not a lot, but we had some. And when I moved here, there were very few.
Wow.
So, you know, over the years, I've often been one of two or three female cardiologists in my medical center. So it's kind of, you just get used to being a little bit different, which you and I were talking about before, is something that, honestly, learning how to live differently and being comfortable in your own shoes is an important skill in life if you're going to do something unique or different.
Sure.
Because you got to be comfortable living in those shoes.
Sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, your interest and your work has been centered around women's heart health, which is a fairly niche.
Well, I wasn't looking for that. So
okay.
It's just funny that, you know, yeah, if you're the girl, then you should study girl stuff. But I actually avoided it early in my career because I didn't want to get, you know, sidelined on something that I'd be sidelined in. And so I really chose not to when I was younger. But honestly, in my medical center, there just weren't any other females. And literally, I was tasked with developing a women's center. I mean, I don't think you could give that test to the man. And so I just took it on. I literally sat down with a colleague, like a friend who worked in the organization that wasn't a physician. And we just wrote down on a napkin all the things that we thought were important. And we just basically decided if they're going to ask us to do this, these were the things that we thought were important. And so we just started literally from scratch. So we were interested in not just a clinical program. We were interested in an education and an outreach, and how could you impact the most women or males that were treating women through an education outreach program. And so we kind of embarked on that about a decade ago.
Wow. Okay.
And literally all the things that we wrote down on that napkin, because we saved it, we kind of did. But we didn't have We had people, of course, that wanted us to do things, this is funny, that would generate money for people, because people tend to want you to do things that make people money. And we decided at the very beginning that this was a philanthropic effort and that our goals were not to make money, but to make goodness. And so we really, really, we refused to do things that were for money. We left that to others to do. There are plenty of people chasing the dollar. We wanted to do something different. And we decided that if we were going to do something truly philanthropic, we should, because we were given of our time for free, and that we should impact people that were at somehow at risk or underserved. And we just winged it. And we just went where the interest, we followed our interest. And things just popped up. And so, you know, we embarked on this big program of an outreach program where we surveyed. Well, it all started with one simple question. We were interested in the diversity of outcomes among women's racial groups, so that it had been known that African-American women fared less well than white women, and Hispanics did better than white women. So there was this sort of Hispanic paradox. And so we first started in our hospital database, and we started looking at the outcomes of women based on their racial demographics. And we found that the outcomes were exactly the same. So, like, once you had disease and you made it into the hospital, the outcomes were identical amongst the groups for women. But the females had worse outcomes than the men. But we were interested in why did some women fare better than others. But it turned out that it couldn't be how they were treated. It had to be before they got disease. So we had to move out of the hospital setting into an outpatient outreach, looking at what the risk factors were for disease in the community, because clearly there were groups that had added risk groups. So we had to move to the community in order to do that. And we had to set up our own. We were driven by this one question. And so by doing so, we just followed our hearts. And by following our hearts, we followed the patients or the groups in the community. So people, we made alliances with the community. So we first made an alliance with the Baker Ripley, yes, and all the Baker programs. And then we made an alliance with the Lesbian Health Initiative, which is now Legacy. And so we had an underserved population in Houston that was very diverse ethnically and, I guess, gender identity. And we didn't have to leave the med center more than 4 miles. I mean,
oh, wow.
If you draw a perimeter around the med center, within 5 miles, you can find a group of people super diverse. So we didn't have to do, like, there have been big national database projects where they collaborate with white people in Minnesota and African Americans in Mississippi and Hispanics in California. This is Houston. It's right around us. So we embarked on including as many groups as we could and giving them free medical care. And that was the carrot to get them to participate in a survey.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It was kind of cool. But it was,
so the program really took off.
Well, it would have, if we had had more time, honestly, at the very beginning, we self-funded. So we just went for it. We were like, I was like, this couldn't be that expensive. And literally, I was going to write a check from our own personal account. The husband didn't know. But and then we got philanthropic money, and we got some grant support. And, you know, in order to get any grants, you have to prove that you're already doing it. So you got to be in the game. So we just jumped into the game and looked around and figured out how to do things. So we made a lot of really good alliances.
Sure.
Yeah.
So something that I'm hearing is that you're catering to a very diverse group of patients, and that can be tough. Getting a message across that may be as complex as managing your health and managing your heart health in particular to a group this diverse, how do you make sure that that message is getting across such a diverse group? How do you know it's not getting lost for some segments of that? population.
You never know for sure, but you have to have people that are from that community that will be your microphone or your listening device, and you have to be able to speak the language.
Sure.
Quite honestly, literally, you have to speak the language. So we employed, you know, we not employed, but we got a big volunteer group. And actually, the volunteer, we couldn't have done what we did if we didn't have the volunteer groups that we had had. And it just kind of grew. Then people want to be involved, and people want to participate because, well, we're looking at an underprivileged population that didn't have access to my team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they couldn't easily just come in and be seen. We went to them. So we went to their neighborhood. We showed up with a huge team of investigators that we did biometric screening, so we collected blood and got blood pressure, and we basically gave them an office visit in a format where I could see 100 and something participants in one day, and we'd sit one-on-one and explain to them what risk they were under, and we'd make them fill out a survey. Mm-hmm. And that survey over time, of course, grew because you start thinking, oh, I need to add this and I need to add that, and it became more complex. But the good part of the study is that the people that actually participated in the survey with the participants, it was one-on-one. It was a super, super small group. We did it the same way every time.
I see.
So it had less observer variability because we did it ourselves.
Great.
Yeah.
So I also want to ask you, you were talking about how your treatment wasn't the thing that caused differences in outcomes for these patients.
Right.
It was before the treatment.
Right.
And so there's a concept called social determinants of health. And, of course, that's...
huge.
Right. And so that's the food you eat, the environment that you're
in. No. Let's be clear. The biggest determinant of who gets cardiovascular disease is your socioeconomic group.
Sure.
Period.
Absolutely. And so all of these things contribute much more than the time that you spend in a hospital. And so to that end, how can women in the community use this knowledge of social determinants of health to make sure that their cardiac health is where it needs to be? Or how can they improve given this knowledge?
Okay, so that's where we started at the very beginning. How can we educate women? How can we educate the women's doctors? Because many women only go to the OBGYN.
Yes.
Right? That's their primary care doctor. Over 40% of women only see the OBGYN. So we kind of targeted those groups for, intensive kind of learning opportunities or sharing, not to be dogmatic. And then we went direct to, consumers, like, know your numbers, so before you make it to the doctor, you got to have some basic idea about your health status. And I think now that most people, even underprivileged people, have access to the internet now. And so we made our website a place that was super, it was really a really important thing that we did, is that we made a big splash on our website for women's health, and we made it user friendly in multiple languages. And in fact, we get more hits at the Texas Heart Institute in Spanish than we do in English, and we're about to go to other languages. Wow. So whatever resources we put out, and we put out resources that are at a learning level for lay people, which is kind of unique and a little bit more difficult to do.
Mm.
Sometimes the editors will make it too easy, and then we have to medical it up. We might write something and then they medical it down, and then we're like, hey, people are pretty savvy about medicine these days, and you can explain it in a way that people can understand it.
Sure.
And not to treat people like they can't understand it, because they can. They want to.
Absolutely. And, that's interesting that you bring it up. I was going to highlight the fact that you've worked with the Texas Heart Institute Journal. You've done quite a bit of work through there. And I was curious as to what challenges you faced trying to communicate really complex ideas about heart health to communities that need this information, and making sure that all of these complex ideas can get boiled down to
simple
ideas that
people
everyone
can take
follow.
Home. Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that's the key to success.
Yeah,
is that whatever your audience is, you need to reach that audience. You know, and the beautiful thing about cardiovascular disease in general, which is just blocked artery disease, is that that disease is largely preventable with really mostly a lifestyle improvement. You have to look at each individual, as you were saying, and look at, I describe it as a gumbo, you know, from close to Louisiana. And coronary disease is a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And you really just have to address each of those risk factors and control them. Some populations develop risk factors for heart disease earlier than others. In those populations, we're failing by not addressing the problems at an earlier stage. I think there's been a lot of really important research on hypertension and its treatment, how we make the diagnosis, what's the strategy for treatment, that have been important in the last few years. And really, they're really simple things that we've only just discovered in the last 4 years, really. You know, there was a recent study looking at monitoring and treating blood pressures out of a barbershop where they looked at, you know, a community of men who frequented a barbershop, and they'd go frequently and they'd get their blood pressure checked, and they were given an algorithm, the barbers, to treat the blood pressure. And guess what? They did a heck of a job treating the blood pressure.
Wow.
Yeah. So the point here is the physician's office may not be the best or the only place that it can be treated. And we're going to have to come up with novel solutions if we're going to take care of a population that's really at risk from the events that are consequences of really just unregulated or unknown blood pressure problems.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is quite a, you know, large portion of the population that has what we call stage one hypertension.
Oh, huge.
And that's especially true in Houston.
It's
compared
huge.
To the rest of the country.
Well,
and
we
so,
have all this salty food.
Yes.
We're a really obese city. The problem with, I don't want to go into just all about blood pressure because I could do a stand-up routine on blood pressure. But I do this in the community because the blood pressure really matters. And remember, the problem with blood pressure is it moves around. And so you don't have any one number to hang your hat on. It's not like, what's your glucose today? Or what's your LDL cholesterol? What's your blood pressure? Well, it's a moving target. You've got the top number and the bottom number. Which one matters? I mean, people get confused. So you need to send out a good message that really blood pressure should be monitored at home or in an ambulatory setting, you know, somewhere away from the doctor's office where you get the population managing and checking their own blood pressure. So then they come into you with a diary. Even on their phone, you know, there's all these great new blood pressure machines that just sync to your phone. They can sync to the doctor's office as well. So those measurements are important. But you got to look at what the overall trend is and what the average is.
I see.
Yeah.
And so are these sorts of interventions the types of things that you're
looking
encouraging
at? Yeah, we,
patients
oh no,
to do?
Every day.
Okay.
They're super important. Sure. It's not just once a year you get your blood pressure checked, and that's like the gold standard. It's not that simple.
Are you finding that having all of this data of all of these patients monitoring their blood pressure every day, just to use that as an example,
overwhelming to
yeah,
the office?
Yes.
Yeah, it can be, but honestly, I really rather prefer. I came from clinic today, so I clinic all day today. I prefer the patient comes in that's an engineer with a spreadsheet. I mean, like that guy's going to get ahead because well, he's going to monitor it, and we're going to make changes based on trends and averages, and compared to the guy who never checks his blood pressure and pretends that it's okay. And it's, you know, I had a guy just like this yesterday, and like he just really didn't want to take any medicine.
Yeah,
you know, it was just really a poor strategy for his life expectancy.
Sure.
And he had to be made to feel like, you know, I can be involved in this, and he has to own his own problem. It's not a problem in the doctor's office. It's a problem for him every day of his life that
right.
his blood pressure is too high. You know, he's damaging his blood vessels, and he's putting himself at risk for adverse cardiac events and dementia.
Mm.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's only two things that are preventive for dementia. One's lifestyle, and one's blood pressure control.
Mm.
And those two things are linked. Right?
I see.
no fancy medicines for Alzheimer's that are really valuable at this point. Did you know that?
Right, yes.
They've spent billions of dollars on the industry, and we're back to blood pressure, exercise, don't eat the wrong foods, and...
And social support, and
yeah.
Being engaged when you're older, that
right.
sort of thing.
I guess the one thing that you could prevent is hearing loss can lead to dementia.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Well, you know, this is a relatively simple-sounding idea, but to apply it at scale is not so simple.
That's right.
And so, you know, of course, we talked about the program and how it took off, but I'm curious, was the Houston ecosystem, did it play a part in allowing it to flourish?
Big time. Okay, so Houston's a very creative and innovative town, and originally when I said I was going to do this outreach in the underserved community, I was told by city leaders that people wouldn't show up, that people wouldn't respond, and it didn't make any sense to me that people wouldn't want to participate when they would receive like this really great thing, which is like an individualized consultation with the real team of doctors. And people weren't as cynical. They weren't at all. People wanted to do it. People wanted to be involved. And I think the creative spirit of the Houston community was certainly a super important. But the collegiality in the medical center was important as well. I know you've interviewed some of my other colleagues who are very creative.
Yes.
And I know that we just have a very innovative and collegial environment where we work, which is literally really great. It's fun to work in a place where people are thinking and wanting to help and, you know, eagerly investigating new things. We still work in a place where, you know, the great creative thinkers in cardiology worked in the same building. And so it lends to a culture of let's try it, let's figure out something new. And when people say you can't do it, you go, why not? We could do that, you know. So we have animal labs below our main medical hospital, and so we do large animal experiments, and we have clinicians that can literally pop in and out with ideas from, you know, the operating room or the electrophysiology suite, and so it's much more interactive than I think it is in other places. When I worked in other hospitals, we had a animal center that was 30 miles away from the med center, you know, and it had a different feel for it. You know, people that worked in the animal labs didn't really come to the hospital or vice versa. And, or if they did, they went for a month at a time. So it's much more interactive where I am.
Sure. And it sounds like to tackle problems as big as this, women's health, women's heart health, it surely takes, people from different professions, from different walks of life working together in close proximity.
Absolutely, and even in different disciplines. So we got a large grant, and for looking at non-vascular causes of heart disease in women. And we, instead of reinventing what somebody else might be doing down the street, we just funded a lab down the street to investigate one of the problems that we were interested in looking at in women. So we did that with the School of Public Health. So we made alliances even with other medical institutes on Fannin Street because,
wow.
Well, we have the largest medical center in the world, and, you know, you shouldn't have to reproduce what somebody else is doing really well down the street if you could just provide them with some funding or an idea to take it in a different way.
Absolutely.
So we've tried that as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so I want to ask a couple of questions now about the future. So I'm curious, what kinds of changes do you anticipate or do you see in women's health in the next, say, 10 or 20 years?
Well, I think there's been a lot more of big box, you know, the American Heart Association grants looking at women's health. So I think there's a lot more, you know, institutional-based interest in women's health and programs investigating that because, you know, women participate less in these clinical trials.
Yes.
I think really just by their nature. You know, women tend to be more skeptical, and men tend to just jump in. And I think that's part of the socialization of being a female and a man. And I think it's probably inherent in the way we think. So I think that a lot of interest and money is moving toward research that's interested in looking at women's health and women's diseases that are important for the future. So I think we're going to see some big developments in some of those fields. I think that in the future you're going to see movement away from hospital-based practice to prevention, which like means you have to go into schools and churches and into people's community centers in order to reach those people, barbershops.
Sure.
Reach them where they are, grocery stores. You know, I mean, I'm just thinking outside the box. I mean, how are we going to affect people? Because really we're going to have to affect them before they know they have disease, you know, because
Absolutely.
We're going to have to talk about degenerative diseases that are really lifestyle related. And so outreach helps a lot. These radio shows help a lot because we get the word out.
Yes.
You know, so I think in respect, that those are two of the things that I think we're going to see. I think there'll be more collaboration between the disciplines, especially like for us on Fannin Street, we work with the Rice engineers, and we're also in the development stages of this innovation center with the TMCX, where business ideas in healthcare intermingling with the medical care, and sometimes we're asked to come to a committee. And we review business ideas from a medical perspective and give our, you know, opinion about, well, maybe that's not going to work, or you have a guy that's already doing this in this field, but maybe you should think like, so, and we're using that to train our young doctors. So, in fact, I'm glad we're having this talk because I just remembered I have to make an appointment with a doctor at Rice because we're going to add a rotation, an innovation rotation for my fellows so that they can be involved in, you know, engineering, development of products.
Wow.
You know, think about what Apple's done. Apple's moving into goal-directed healthcare at the individual level, you know. They're hiring cardiologists.
Right.
They're looking at monitoring. Honestly, it's great for us because patients are using their Apple Watch to monitor their heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
It would be really wonderful, engineers out there, if you could find a product where you could monitor people's blood pressure, you know, without a cuff.
Right.
There's got to be something out there. Impedance, something. Something's got to be coming because that would be great.
Well, with the, you know, interdisciplinary collaboration with the TMC and Rice engineers, that probably is not too far away.
Well, we've been talking about it. So
yeah.
It's kind of, I'm eager for it. I went to a meeting about a year and a half ago, and I sat down. The first thing I said is, I need a blood pressure cuff that's, you know, available, that's, you know, you can wear and you get results without it impairing your ability to do your job or, you know.
Sure.
So.
And what about you? What are your lofty goals for the future, if you had one or two?
Well, I'm hoping to get both my daughters out of college and gainfully employed in a kind of a job that's meaningful. You know, I'm really not interested in, I mean, I'm interested in having a meaningful life, and I would want that for my daughters and for my fellows. I want doctors at the table as opposed to just, you know, MBAs. I want doctors, and I think that doctors have to be, they have to give up something in order to participate in on those levels, because I think the doctor has a unique perspective. He touches patients, literally. And he sees things in a different manner than the hospital may or a business would. So I'm for doctors being involved in the business of medicine. And I'm encouraging my young doctors to step up and take a step toward those kinds of committee responsibilities. Because if we don't step up, then we don't have anybody to blame but ourselves for not participating. You may not get any money for it, and it may be painful. It's painful sometimes to participate in those committees, but I think they're meaningful. I think that I would never want to give up patient care. I think it informs everything I do, and I didn't know that when I was younger. I don't see myself retiring. I don't know what I would do. I really like being in medicine, and I think that I'd like for other people to join our team that are passionate for, you know, doing that, which is hard and wonderful and fun and complicated, and it's all of those things that make life rewarding, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Me too.
Absolutely. And it certainly makes a big difference in the community to have people driven and working on endeavors that are specifically focused on patients that need it most. Underserved communities,
yeah.
Marginalized communities, and that sort
we
of thing.
We forget about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
if you forget, you know, if you're only taking care of that which comes in your door, and your door is levied by you have to have insurance, or you have to be qualified, or you have to know the right people, because, you know, as medicine becomes more constrained, right, we all get the same reimbursement, you know, it becomes who you know, if you can get in to see, you know, the right doctor.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So that's a problem for medicine.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's probably one that's going to take a while to work itself out.
Well, I think we're in a great period of uncertainty because, as you know, like healthcare costs are, I mean, they have risen from 11% of family income in 2000 to almost 24%. I saw a statistic and a beautiful slide. Well, the costs are rising, but what we get for it, it didn't go up. Where'd the money go? Like, the doctors don't get any more money. I mean, where did all that money go? So I think that streamlining and getting the doctors at the level of the patient or physician, you know, extenders, I think could save us a lot of money if we get to the, if we could get to people earlier.
Absolutely.
Know?
Okay. Well, Dr. Coulter, I want to thank you for telling us about such an important part of medicine, as well as your own experiences advocating for women's heart health. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Stephanie Coulter, a cardiologist at the Texas Medical Center and the director of the Center for Women's Heart and Vascular Health, speaking about women's heart health and how our approach to it is changing and will continue to change in the future. That's it for today. Tune in next time to Thinking Different for more conversations with leaders in the Houston community who are tackling problems in unique ways. I'm Rishabh Kothari.